Anything else here?
Call the meeting
of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division to order. A quorum is present. Our CLA is out sick today, so we have no minutes to approve. So we're going to start with our first bill, House File 411. Representative Poppy, clean water funding provided, bonds issued, and money appropriated. I will move that House File 411 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommended re-referral to capital investment.
No.
Representative Poppy, I believe there's an author's amendment.
There is. There is, Mr. Chair.
I would move the A1 amendment to get the, maybe Representative Poppy, if you could describe the amendment.
Yes. Is this on? The amendment will allow for, we did already pass a bill on the House floor, and that's been signed into law, so that took care of the issue that we had regarding the appropriation bonds and how money was being spent. This gets us back to what the request is through the governor's proposal and the request by the agency to get money for funding these projects.
Is there any discussion? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Amendment is adopted. Representative Poppy, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will turn things over to my testifier in the interest of time because he can describe what we are doing here and the need and why we are before you. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Proceed.
Chair and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify in support of House File 411 here today. So I have a quick statement and then a quick analogy here for you. So my name is C.J. Hall, okay. And I'm the city administrator in Wells, Minnesota. I'm here on behalf of my city, as well as the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, an organization of more than 97 cities throughout the state. We strongly support House File 411, which will provide $67 million in GO bonds for the PFA, for point source grants and water infrastructure fund grants and loans. Those grants and loans will be used for a variety of wastewater, sewer, and stormwater projects designed to protect Minnesota waters. Wells and the other CGMC cities play an essential role in protecting Minnesota's waters through their wastewater and stormwater systems. The CGMC and its members thank this committee and the legislature for passing House File 80, which freed up PFA money that was the subject of a lawsuit. However, that bill only provided a portion of the current need for PFA funding. My city, like many Minnesota municipalities, is wrestling with high chloride levels in its wastewater, which can cause significant environmental damage to Minnesota waters. In other words, there is too much salt that is being released from our facility, and this can kill plants and fish. To address this issue, Wells plans to build a water plant that will cost more than $6 million. Wells is a city with close to 2,300 residents. We also provide water and services to Minnesota Lake with a population of 690 and Easton with a population of 190. There's no way that our residents and businesses could afford this project without state assistance. An anticipated point source implementation grant will make this project possible. Our project is ready to go. If the point source money were to become available, we will immediately move forward with formal plans and specs for bidding. We just need the financial assistance to move forward with these essential projects. We're not the only city with crucial water projects ready to go. Hoyt Lakes needs to upgrade its facilities to remove mercury from water flowing into Lake Superior, as required by the Great Lakes Initiative and its permit. It has been waiting for a point source grant and cannot move forward without this legislation. The city of Staples is ready to proceed with a $10 to $12 million wastewater facility upgrade that will reduce nutrients and heavy metals flowing to the Mississippi River. We believe a bonding bill is needed this year to fund these projects. Delaying or underfunding the PFA will only make the list of projects grow longer and cause costs to escalate, as well as delay important upgrades to improve the health of our waters. We thank Representative Poppy and all the co-authors for bringing House File 411 forward. We ask this committee and the legislature for your support so we can get to work keeping Minnesota waters clean. The analogy I kind of have here is my wife and I have two cars, as I suppose many families do. We have a 2005 and a 2013 car. They're modern cars. They have some Bluetooth capabilities, airbags, backup cameras, tire pressure, probably much like many of the cars that you guys drive. However, I doubt anybody here is driving a 1958 car as their daily driver. Yet we use 1958 infrastructure to provide daily water to our citizens. We have to meet present-day needs with 60-year-old technology. We are in rural Minnesota, frugal by nature, and we don't want an Audi necessarily, but we would like a modern Chevy for our citizens' water, and it would help us out now and in the future. I appreciate your time.
Any questions for the testifier or the author? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Representative Poppy, any closing remarks?
Thank you. I appreciate your support and would like to go to the bonding committee. Thank you.
I will renew my motion that House File 411, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommended re-referral to capital investment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ways and Means Amendment.
Representative Bierman. Representative Bierman. Representative Lee. Oh, Representative Bierman's here. I will move that House File 2022 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommended re-referral to the Energy and Climate Finance and Policy Division. Representative Bierman, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you to the committee for having me today. I'm before you with HF 2022, which would allow funding to put electric vehicle charging stations in Minnesota state parks. This bill will make state parks more accessible to drivers of plug-in vehicles, especially in rural areas. I speak with a lot of people who are interested in getting electric vehicles. Their number one concern is the lack of charging stations in the places that they want to go to. Minnesota needs a comprehensive build-out of charging stations for electric vehicles. There are some other bills in the works on getting those charging stations into the main corridors where most travel occurs. And businesses have, in fact, taken the lead in this area, in the metro areas, because they figured out the charging stations attract people to their stores and get them to be there for 1 or 2 hours at a time. Some of the leaders in that are Target and Walgreens, for instance. But what about the state parks? In Minnesota, only 4 of 67 of our parks have charging stations, and we want to encourage people to utilize the parks more, and once they get there, having this as a resource for them would be better service for them and fulfill the needs of Minnesotans. This expansion for people heading to the state parks who enjoy the outdoors and green spaces and have an environmental recognition that they want to stay green are the same people that are buying and getting the electric vehicles. So as this expansion occurs, we just don't want to leave the state parks out of it, and I would encourage you to consider this funding as Minnesota goes forward and builds out and we take our steps toward a cleaner, carbon-free environment. Electric vehicles will be one of the main drivers of making Minnesota a cleaner, more friendly environmental place to live, and would welcome questions.
Are there any questions? Representative Lewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not familiar with the current stations as they exist right now, but is there a mechanism so that the user is able to pay for that electricity, or would that end up, the electric bill end up having to be paid by the state parks?
Representative Bierman.
So I think the actual system of how this will be funded longer term would be that individuals would drive to the park and they would pay for that service. It would be inexpensive, you know, as little as $2 to $3, sometimes a dollar, depending on the time and the type of charger that is installed. There's a variance between a level 1, level 2, and level 3 charger. I think most of these in the parks would probably be level 2. But I see it as an investment by the state to put some seed money into this to get the infrastructure built and facilitate not only the use of the parks and for people with electric vehicles, but this exponential growth in electric vehicles that we're going to be seeing over the next years. We're on the cusp of really having an explosion in electric vehicles, and we need the infrastructure in the state of Minnesota to back it up. There's a lot of states across the country that are much further along than we are.
It's just so at least at this point, then the parks would obviously be on the hook to pay the electric bill. Is that not correct for that facility, with some opportunity to change it to a user pay type situation in the future?
Representative Bierman.
So exactly when it would start in transition, I mean, I think that this bill would address just the fact of getting the stations set up and ready for pay, and I think that's you would pay the first time you use it. So I see it as more of a cost, not to the state after they're set up.
Representative Lewis.
I appreciate that, and I guess I struggle with state rec areas and parks in my area, and they're having a heck of a time keeping their bathrooms and other facilities up. I'm very sensitive to putting even a nickel of extra cost on at least the facilities up where I'm at, because they have such a struggle making sure that they're first-class facilities relative to the normal restrooms, stuff like that. So it's just an area to really keep an eye on.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Bierman, you said that you're particularly interested in state parks in rural Minnesota. The money for this idea is coming out of the Renewable Development Fund. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, yes, that's correct.
Okay. So, as I read the bill, I think that the park has to be located in what would currently be the XL Energy area. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, yes, that is correct.
Okay. So can you tell me which state parks will receive funding for this?
Representative Bierman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I cannot tell you precisely the state parks that will receive it.
Is there someone here from DNR that can tell us? Or XL?
Doesn't appear that there is. Oh, we
shoes.
Have somebody.
I'm here with the DNR, but.
Representative Fabian, if you want to re-ask your question.
Thank you. So, welcome, Director Leversedge. Tell me specifically which parks are going to be receiving money from this bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian.
Just state your name for the record.
Okay. Phil Leversedge, Deputy Director of Minnesota State Parks and Trails. We have not assessed which parks are located in XL Energy's service area at this time. I do know of the four parks that we currently have set up with electric charging stations. One of them, Fort Snelling State Park, is within XL Energy's service area, and that system was put in through a grant from XL Energy. But we can find that information for you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what conversations have you had, Mr. Leversedge, Director Leversedge, with the author of the bill regarding how this would roll out?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, we haven't had conversations. We have expressed an interest in working with the author of the bill. We generally support the concept, and we have been working to try to find ways to expand opportunities for charging stations in our parks.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you. And to Director Leversedge, to Representative Lewick's comments, do you think that the state of Minnesota and the parks should be paying for the electricity, or should the users be paying for the electricity?
Director Levisich.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I can talk about what's currently happening. We have one station at Big Bog State Recreation Area that was put in by Beltrami Electric Co-op. That one has a credit card validator, so the customer is paying there. That's our most recent installation. We have two stations on the North Shore, one at Gooseberry Falls, one at Tattagoose, and those were put in partnership with the Co-op Light and Power out of Two Harbors. The agreement there, and this was really to try to gauge what the response of use would be, the agreement there is that the state, MnDOT, and DNR are paying the first $500 of incidental costs per year, and then the electric co-op is picking up anything over $500. I don't have data on exactly what the cost per year has been, but that's the current arrangements there. And I believe at Fort Snelling, the state is picking up that cost.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate that we want to do charging stations, but I'm very much opposed to the taxpayers and the ratepayers picking up the charges on this. If you can afford to spend $100,000 on a Tesla, you can certainly afford to spend $2.50 to get your car charged. Is that not correct? To the author and the Representative Deputy Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I agree with you 100% that these charging stations should be set up so that the vehicle owner is picking up the fee for the charge every single time, in my opinion.
Okay. Representative Fabian.
So then, Mr. Chair, I don't know what the plan is. They're asking for $4.1 million. We don't know. I don't think we know how many charging stations. I don't know if we know how much the cost is per station. So walk me through what the plan is here, Director Levisich and Representative Bierman.
Well, I think the first plan would be to do a study and to figure out where the charging stations would be most appropriate, and that would the exact cost of a station itself is somewhere between $2,000 and $3,000 for a level 2 charger.
Okay.
So I guess that's the first plan, is to, as you've noted, look at and talk to Xcel about their rate area, the parks within that area, budget out the amount, get contract proposals from the suppliers who would actually build these stations, set them up, and then be able to proceed based on the amount of dollars available.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Bierman, what conversations have you had with Xcel, and what's the plan? How do they is Xcel here, by the way? I think I asked that earlier, but
I don't believe they are, Representative.
My conversations with Xcel have not revolved around this bill, actually. There wasn't a lot of that. I've had some meetings with Xcel on other issues, but this charging bill was just something that I wanted to put forward so that we could get it in the works and to then figure out the details on how we were going to lay this out. I mean, if I had a full plan in implementation, I certainly would have brought that to the committee today, but unfortunately I do not.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how did you come up with $4.1
million? That was actually, let's see, that one. Where did that come from? Maybe I could ask for Bob to help me out on that question.
Mr. Eliff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I'm not sure specifically. Obviously, it fit into the overall plan of the Energy Committee in terms of electric vehicle support, because as Representative Bierman mentioned, there are other bills to support electric vehicle charging stations that are going through that committee. And obviously what was available in the Renewable Development Fund played into that number as well.
I think Representative Fabian, so the question in our jurisdiction here is, in state parks, is this a valuable tool? The funding is going to come in Representative Wagenius's committee, and those questions should be handled in there. But so most of the chain of questioning has been about the funding. Our funding is within this purview on the state parks, and should it be done in the state parks? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just real quickly then, doing some quick math, $4.1 million, that's just about 1,400 charging stations. I don't know what, but if the number that you gave Representative Bierman is accurate, about $3,000. I used the high end. You said $2,000 to $3,000 per installation. That's just about 1,400 stations. So, again, I'm not opposed to it necessarily, but I don't think that the taxpayers and the park, I think that the users of the stations need to be paying for the charging stations. So.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Fabian, I agree with you entirely on that point.
So just one last thing, Mr. Chair, I mean, does the Parks Director Leversedge, where is DNR on this whole concept?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, the bill is relatively new to us, so we are studying it. It is not part of the governor's recommendation, so we didn't take a firm position on it. But we are interested in working with the author to refine some of the details.
I have three members on the list. So Representative New, Representative Sandell, Representative Becker-Fitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bierman, I'm curious about some of the language here. In Subdivision 2, it says that the PCA must develop and fund installation of the network. And then it goes on to say that in the RFP, then on page 2, it says alternative arrangements that may be made to allocate responsibility for a number of other things, including ownership, operation, and maintenance. How do you foresee that playing out? Who exactly will be responsible for the maintenance of these?
Representative Bierman.
Well, I think that would need to be worked out as we seek and obtain bids for the project, the installation, and which companies are actually going to be going forth with that and then running the charging stations. Maintenance would be their responsibility.
Thank you.
Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative New and Fabian anticipated my questions. Thank you.
Representative Becker-Fitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of wanted to state so that the public isn't under the impression that only the extremely wealthy can buy electric vehicles. I just Googled it, and you can buy a used Nissan Leaf for $9,000 or a used Volt for $14,000. So I think the number of folks who are buying these vehicles is broader and includes people from many different income levels, just not only the wealthy who can afford a Tesla as much as they may want to purchase one of those vehicles. So just want to get that on the record.
Is there anyone from the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Anyone from the audience? Representative Bierman, any closing remarks?
No, I think, Mr. Chair and representatives, thank you very much for all the very good questions on the bill. This process makes bills better and stronger, and I would ask for your strong consideration of this bill as we go forward with more and more development of electric vehicles on our roads, and will contribute to a better Minnesota for all of us through cleaner air. And appreciate your support. Thank you.
I will renew my motion that House File 2022 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommended re-referral to the Energy and Climate Finance Policy Division. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Motion is approved. Representative Lee. Representative Lee, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1583 in front of the committee.
1853.
Yes.
And Representative Lee, I believe you have an author's amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do have the author's amendment. The A2 amendment is clarifying language to say that the $10 million appropriation to the Pollution Control Agency, and the bill is for the development of electric vehicle charging stations that are accessible for all members of the public.
Representative Lee moves the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion? Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Amendment is adopted. Representative Lee, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. So majority of these funds will go to DC fast chargers, which will go along highways and interstates to allow longer distance travel throughout the state. And, Mr. Chair, you know, this bill is important for me, and I really want us to look at this through an environmental justice lens and see how could we invest in public infrastructure that will promote alternatives like electric vehicles to the current cars that we have out on the highways. And, you know, we know that there are cars out there that emit pollutions, and, you know, we also know that pollution disproportionately impact communities like mine, communities that have a high concentration of communities of color and people who are economically disadvantaged. And, Mr. Chair, I had the pages pass out an article that was from the Associated Press and NPR News titled Blacks, Hispanics Breathe More Pollution Than They Make. And I find that relevant to what we're talking about today. And just a little bit about the article, it talks about a study that was published Monday in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that looked at who is exposed to fine particle pollution and how much different races are responsible for the pollution based on their buying, driving, and living habits. And the article quoted Jason Hill, a biosystem engineering professor at the University of Minnesota, that says, quote, even though minorities are contributing less to the overall problem of air pollution, they are affected by it more. This article stated that this pollution comes from gases from smokestacks, tailpipes, and other places when the researchers look at pollutions from highways, coal-fired power plants, and other sources. And, Mr. Chair, this confirms past research that the inequity in pollution exposure exists for people of color because of their close proximity to major highways and industrial pollution. So with this in context, we must do what we can to alleviate the air pollution resulting from our driving of the cars that we have out there right now on our major highways. And it is important for us to consider the benefits that electric vehicles have for all Minnesotans, that they have no, that the EVs have no tailpipe emissions, so they will improve air quality and public health. And they will also significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions, help integrate renewable energy, and if charged overnight, can help lower electricity rates for all customers. And, Mr. Chair, I would like to turn it over to my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Andrew Twite with Fresh Energy. We're a St. Paul-based nonprofit organization that provides research and analysis on energy issues across the state. We're very supportive of the bill. I think it would provide a much-needed support for electric vehicles because though EVs are growing in popularity, they still face a bit of a chicken-and-the-egg problem when it comes to the chargers because you need a wide network of charging infrastructure before most people will be willing to purchase an EV. But at the same time, you can't make a profitable business model for private investment in EV charging infrastructure until there's a larger number of cars on the road. So I think this would provide some much-needed support at the early stages to help spur electric vehicle growth in Minnesota, which in turn, as the representative said, will help lower emissions, improve public health, and lower electric bills, among other things. So thank you for the opportunity to talk, and we urge you all to support this bill.
Any questions for Representative Lee or his testifier? Any questions? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Do we have somebody to testify? Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 1853. My name is Alexis Donath, and I'm from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Expanding the state's network of EV charging infrastructure is a priority of the Walz administration and an important step toward helping Minnesota achieve its greenhouse gas reduction goals. Even when charged on the existing grid, the transportation sector has eclipsed electricity generation as the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the state. Even when charged on the existing grid, electric vehicles are a much cleaner source, generating less than half of the carbon dioxide equivalent and one-third of the NOx of gasoline vehicles. Electric vehicles charged with renewables have, for all practical purposes, zero emissions. Building out the state's electric vehicle infrastructure is part of our state plan under the Volkswagen settlement. However, the settlement language limits the amount that can be spent on EV infrastructure to 15% of the settlement. In our outreach efforts surrounding the VW settlement, we heard loud and clear from Minnesotans that they were interested in seeing more EV infrastructure across the state. In his budget, the governor recommends $1.5 million in general funds and $50,000 in ongoing funding for EV infrastructure. And while House File 1853 differs from the governor's budget recommendations, we do welcome the opportunity for continued conversation about how the MPCA and our partners can work together to increase the number of EVs on the road. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I am happy to stand for questions.
Any questions for the Pollution Control Agency? Any questions? Representative Lee, do you want to renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members for the opportunity to present House File 1853. And I do renew my motion.
Representative Lee renews his motion that House File 1853, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommended re-referral to the Energy and Climate Finance and Policy Division. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it.
Thank you.
You're on your way. Representative Cleborn. I will move that House File 2061 be recommended to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommended re-referral to the Legacy Finance Division. Representative Cleborn, would you please present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Representative Janine Cleborn, and I'm here today asking for your support of House File 2061, seeking financial support for the University of Minnesota Forever Green Initiative to protect our natural resources and provide increased efficiency and profitability for farmers by incorporating perennial and winter annual crops into the existing agricultural systems. In Minnesota, we have a rich heritage of protecting our environment and investing in and growing our eco-centered and agricultural economies. Today, I come before you not only as a fellow legislator, but as the fifth generation entrusted with our family farm, which is located much further down the Mississippi River. Minnesota's water quality has a direct impact on Minnesotans and those living and working downstream. I want to thank each of you for your commitment to our environment, and thank you for the support investments made to the Forever Green Initiative over the years, and thank you for seeing the power and value of this important visionary work. Forever Green has been described as the next generation of clean water crops. It is an innovative, non-GMO cropping system that protects our waters and allows farmer profitability. Forever Green is a natural tool for soil health and erosion prevention, keeping our water clean by protecting our farmers' wells, our rivers, and our streams. Forever Green is a win-win for our cities and for Greater Minnesota. It's good for agriculture, for food, and for our environment. While I personally am not an agronomist or environmental expert, I do have several testifiers with me today who have those credentials. I'm asking you today to stand with our university and our state's visionary leaders in support of this important, innovative work by supporting House File 2061. I have with me several testifiers today, and the first one will be Mitch Hunter. He is a postdoctoral research scientist from the Department of Agronomy and Plant Genetics at the University of Minnesota. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hunter, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mitch Hunter, and I'm a postdoctoral researcher with the Forever Green Initiative at the University of Minnesota. As an agronomist, I believe that Forever Green crops are a potential game changer for water quality, soil health, wildlife, and pollinators in Minnesota. Keeping a living root in the soil all year round can stop nitrates from ending up in our groundwater, our wells, and our lakes, rivers, and streams. This means that the nitrogen is being used to grow crops rather than becoming a pollutant. One of these new crops is Kernza intermediate wheatgrass, the first commercially viable perennial grain crop. As a perennial, Kernza can be planted once and then harvested over multiple years. It keeps the soil covered all year long and produces a very deep and dense root system. In one study, we showed that Kernza reduced soil water nitrate concentration in June by 97% compared to corn. Another set of new forever green crops are winter oilseeds, specifically pennycress and camelina. These are planted in the fall and grow over the winter, just like a traditional cover crop, but they can be harvested as a cash crop the following spring. A recent study has shown that pennycress and camelina can reduce nitrates in soil water by over 90% over the fall, winter, and spring, compared to a standard practice of no cover. In short, there is huge potential for forever green crops to improve water quality in Minnesota. However, these crops are still in an early development stage. We need long-term research programs on each of these crops to make them profitable and attractive for farmers to grow. I encourage each of you to support this bill so that we can realize our shared goal of a clean environment and thriving farms. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'd like to go through all the testifiers before we do questions. So.
That's fine. Mr. Chair, may I please ask Kayla Altendorf to come?
Ms. Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kayla Altendorf, and I am a graduate student in the Department of Agronomy and Plant Genetics. 2 points I want to make today. The first is the Forever Green Initiative is unique to the state of Minnesota and attracts high-quality, solution-oriented students to the state and to the university. Two, the support of the Forever Green Initiative so far has allowed us to make tremendous progress in the development of new crops that allow us to meet our environmental, agricultural, and economic goals. In 2013, I initiated a national search for a graduate program that would prepare me to meet my career goals. I spoke to scientists, read the literature, visited different programs, and it became very clear to me that early on, all signs were pointing to the University of Minnesota and to the Forever Green Initiative. The Forever Green Initiative has provided me unique opportunities that have significantly contributed to my development as a scientist. During my master's, I laid the groundwork for a breeding program for a new crop, pennycress. During my PhD, I've played an important role in the development of the world's first commercialized perennial grain crop. The prospect of these opportunities is what initially drew me to the university, what kept me here for my PhD, and what attracts and keeps talented scientists and students in Minnesota. Throughout my involvement in the program, I have witnessed the tremendous progress that Forever Green has made in the development of new crops. After 8 years of development, this fall we'll release the world's first variety of Kernza, a new perennial grain crop to the farmers of Minnesota. In 7 years, we've taken pennycress from a wild species to a crop that's ready for research and testing across the state. We've leveraged the support we've received from the state through MDA to gain additional support from the USDA, the Department of Energy, and private companies and foundations like General Mills, PepsiCo, and the Walton Family Foundation. You'll hear more about this support firsthand from Gabe, who will testify after me. There are many more Forever Green crops in the pipeline, which you'll find in your booklet. With continued and improved funding for the ongoing breeding and agronomic research, we'll be able to announce the release of additional new crops that will help us meet our shared goal of achieving environmental, economic, and agricultural sustainability.
President Cleaver.
Mr. Chair, may I invite Gabe to the podium, please?
Welcome.
All right, very good. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Gabe Guzmini. I'm the director of Crop Improvement Organization in PepsiCo. About 5 years ago, we made a fairly significant commitment to get involved in research in cropping systems and genetics of crops in order to improve the value of the commodities and raw materials that enter our supply chain, and at the same time lower the environmental impact of the supply chains that deliver them. As part of that investment, we identified that a partnership with the University of Minnesota was a key element to success, and it's one of the attractive elements of that partnership was definitely a Forever Green program. Because of my career, I've traveled around the world, and I know most of the research organizations that work in agriculture worldwide, and I must say that I've never met another program like Forever Green that's structured in a way with all the technical skill sets and capability and the right strategy and right leadership to actually make an impact in terms of introducing new crops into cropping system to make a significant change in how agriculture impacts the environment, so that agriculture can become part of the solution and not being part of the problem as it's been seen so far. Our particular interest is at this moment in a couple of the crops, and we have some graduate students who are sponsoring in research in those crops, and we have a fairly large number of our scientists on the campus. We have about 12 people on the campus working on these and other programs with the university, because these crops not only bring environmental advantage and economic advantage for the farmers, but they also bring a nutritional advantage introducing new elements into diets in terms of fiber, proteins, and so on that are lacking in many cases. Thank you very much for the opportunity, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to invite Bruce Miller.
Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bruce Miller with Minnesota Farmers Union. Farmers Union is happy to be here today in support of this Forever Green legislation. I might begin by just noting that today is National Agriculture Day, so happy National Agriculture Day. What a great opportunity to talk about an aspect of agriculture that seems to be working and needs to keep working. The Forever Green Initiative at the University of Minnesota is a program that we have supported since we've been involved with it, since we've known about it. It does develop profitable new crops and creates a new viable economic opportunity for some farmers. Farmers who are looking for markets are finding these products are encouraging and supporting the University of Minnesota. This proposal gives some certainty of a base budget so that the students you heard can be attracted and kept in Minnesota. The professors who have led this project for many, many years can stay here, and that we can create new people. So the encouragement of this program through your support today really does help us build a stronger connection between agriculture, the University of Minnesota, and the development of new farm products, new crops that really can benefit the whole state. And I'm just going to take one quick second here to talk about Kernza. For those of you who come to the Minnesota State Fair at all, if you're at the Minnesota Farmers Union building, we have an awesome BLT on bread that is baked out of Kernza by the Birchwood Cafe in Minneapolis. So it's a Kernza sandwich. So it's a demonstration that even on a small scale, this is a viable product. I also am just going to give a nod to the Bang Brewery in St. Paul, Minnesota, where they are using Kernza to brew Kernza beer. So there are opportunities for these kind of products, and farmers farm to markets, and this creates a new market. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and I hope you'll support this bill.
Thank you. Representative Cleburne.
Mr. Chair, may I please invite Steve Morris to the podium?
Mr. Morris.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to share a few thoughts on this important piece of legislation, and thank you to Representative Claiborne for sponsoring this legislation. A couple of things. I have a letter here that is being distributed now from Minnesota Environmental Partnership with a number of groups who've signed on to this as one of our priorities. It's an issue that we've worked on for a number of years. And one of the reasons that we feel so strongly about, and you'll see a large group of a number of organizations co-signing this, is it has really dramatic environmental impacts. And so you've heard about the market impacts, the research interest, but it also has really dramatic water quality impacts. And let me just frame it up this way. For a generation, I and others have been working on the agricultural water challenge, if you will. It's a really difficult, kind of a wicked problem, very difficult to solve with a lot of dynamics. And we've kind of gone after it in two approaches. One approach is to keep agriculture on the land and then deal with how we manage the crop, fertilizer rates, tillage rates, education, outreach, modifying practices. In addition, there have been attempts and some new regulations that have been put in place, especially over the last few years, to have an impact on ag water quality. But it's often slow progress, and quite frankly, it's very contentious. The second track we've taken is to take land out of agricultural production. And so that's things like RIM, CRP, set-aside programs that take land out of production, and it gives us all these ecological benefits that you've been hearing today, habitat, water, soil health. Well, this is a new way. This combines the best of both of those. It gives us the conservation values of the set-aside lands while providing an agricultural crop for farmers. And so we think it's a really unique opportunity that we hope that you'll take hold of and support very robustly. The other point I would make is that it's non-regulatory. We've had a lot of discussions about regulation in agriculture over the last few years. This is non-regulatory, which makes it kind of easier to get there, if you will. But it also means that over the long run, it will be cheaper once this model works, as it has many times here in Minnesota already with university research, and it will be more durable. So it won't be something you do now and then you lose and go backwards on in the future. The last point I want to make is I hope everyone really appreciated the broad coalition of people who are behind this, farmers, researchers, big business, small business, advocates, legislators who are thinking down the road. So it's really a unique opportunity to think about how we can solve one of these intractable problems and benefit many different sectors at the same time. So we appreciate your support and your robust consideration when you get to the numbers part of this. Thank you.
Members, any questions for the testifiers? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, just from perspective of what we've done in the past, this is a $10 million total appropriation. What's been done in the previous bienniums?
Mr. Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian. You know, I should go back and look, but we've probably been getting state funding in one form or another for about the last 5 years. It's been hovering around $1 million a year. Last biennium, it actually was a little bit less than that. It was $750,000. We got a little bit of a dip in the budget. This year, as part of the Clean Water Council recommendations, there's $2.8 million in the package. And, you know, what I'd say is I think we've proven the concept that this stuff is really out there, practical, and can work with a lot of interest. And now this is to take it to the next step. So it is a bump up, but it's intentional.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's kind of my point, is the council recommended 2.8. What conversations have you had with the council about 5 and 5?
Mr. Morris.
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair.
Well, you know, there's so many powerful women leading things around here, you know. Sometimes I slip up. Mr. Chair.
It's okay.
We have presented some of these concepts to the Clean Water Council. We support the council recommendation, the whole package, as it came forward from the council. What I'm doing here today is testifying in support of Forever Green and understand that in the end, you know, you're the decision makers. You'll decide where things get funded. But we do support the package the way the council brought it forward. And Representative Claiborne introduced the bill asking for clean water funds. And so this is something that will be on the table along with a general fund request.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then to that point, Representative Claiborne, what conversations have you had with the council?
Excuse me. I have actually not spoken to the council as a council body. I have spoken to different members about it, asking for their additional support. I have spoken to many legislators asking for additional support. What I'm trying to do is we have a program at our University of Minnesota which is truly visionary. And while we have had this a smaller amount of support, significant yet smaller amount of support, now in order to truly ramp up the program and to take it into the broad landscape of farmers' fields and protect those wellheads of our farmers and to protect our rivers and streams, this is an avenue, as I see it, which would be different as far as allowing farmers to have an opportunity right now to have an economic impact in their fields so that when all of these rains are coming and the snow is melting, we are protecting our soil and we are protecting our water. So to answer your question, I have talked to many, many people, but I can't say that I have gone to a group to speak to them as a whole.
President Fagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of things more real quickly. Mr. Miller, you said that there's been several new profitable crops that have been developed as a result of this program. Can you name some of those for me, please? And just for the record, I don't know how many people in this room can raise their hand and say that they've actually stood in a kernel of wheat field and watched it being combined. I have. So,
Mr. Miller.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, Pennycrest, Camelina, And then, of course, Kernza, which is really developing. The other ones that are in process right now, winter barley, the perennial flax, hazelnuts, berries, some summer annual grains. I mentioned the pennycress, perennial sunflowers, and then woody perennials, and then cover crops of a variety of they're experimenting with a number of it. I think that's one of the things that is so visionary about this is they're taking dreams and making them realities. And so, yes, Kearns is actually pretty fascinating. If you get a chance, if anybody hasn't, to see the poster of the Kearns root system, it's like 15 feet deep. It's just an amazing, amazing perennial wheat.
Mr. Chair, Fabian. We also have an expert from the University of Minnesota who may be able to answer these questions more fully, if Mr. Fabian would like.
We don't need.
Okay, thank you. Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and then finally, obviously everybody knows that I'm a huge supporter of farmers and agriculture and ranchers and so forth. And one of the concerns that I have is in your opening comments, you talked about these being non-GMO. For the University of Minnesota, do you explicitly eliminate any GMO research?
I will bring someone up. I do not believe that would be the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative.
Ms. Altendorf.
Can you please re-ask your question?
In the opening comments, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Claiborne said something, made reference to these things being non-GMO. Mm-hmm. GMOs play an amazingly important role in agriculture. What is the university's position in regards to the Forever Green program with regards to GMOs?
Thank you, Representative, for the question. To answer your question, so far we've used only traditional breeding approaches on all of the Forever Green crops. We have not utilized GMO technology at this point. I would say in part because we feel like we don't need to. Maybe in the future, and I also agree that GMOs play a very important role in agriculture, and I don't think we have a formal stance on that for Forever Green. It's just we haven't come to that point yet.
Sure. And finally, Mr. Chair, I have a good friend who raises soybeans, and he's created a niche market, and he raises non-GMO soybeans. Mm-hmm. And for people who think that non-GMO soybeans are the end-all be-all because of chemicals and so forth or whatever, he said if I put the chemicals on the tailgate of the pickup that I put on my Roundup Ready soybeans versus my non-GMO soybeans, people wouldn't eat the non-GMO soybeans because they make many more passes over and put many more herbicides and chemicals and stuff on the non-GMOs.
Mr. Chair, may I address the question as well?
Representative Claiborne.
Representative Fabian, I am in no way denigrating. I just want to make sure that you know I am also a farmer, and we use products that are both GMO and non-GMO.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I to the Kearns field, I'm not sure how many members actually had the Kearns sandwich at the state fair, but I there really are a lot of possibilities there. I know, you know, as a consumer, I've actually wondered how we could get access to it so that, you know, we can incorporate it into the things that normal consumer, you know, your average consumer that doesn't own a restaurant would have access to that as well.
Representative Claiborne.
That is a question that I can take back to Dr. Wise at the University of Minnesota and get further information for you.
Any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Anyone in the audience? Representative Claiborne, any closing remarks?
Mr. Chair, I would just like to thank the members one more time for your support with this important program. It has been decades in the making and decades of investment from our state to the University of Minnesota. I encourage your full support for this bill, and thank you very much for your time and consideration. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I will renew my motion that House File 2061 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommended re-referral to the Legacy Finance Division. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Motion is approved.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hewitt. I move that House File 970 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Hewitt,
there is
have
an
author's amendment.
Thank you.
It is an author's amendment, Mr. Chair.
I will move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Amendment is approved. Representative Hewitt, to House File 970 as amended.
House File 970 addresses the Minnesota Zoo, one of our greatest assets that we have here in Minnesota. It's located in my district out in 57B. And unfortunately, the zoo is tired. It's 40 years old, and it's in the middle of a major pinnacle in its future here. I know that this legislator has been supportive in the past on what they can do. I know the Representative Wills before me tried to do what she could do. However, we need to focus. We need to get it as much help as it can, because we need to return it to its glory and see what the future is at the Minnesota Zoo. This bill that I bring before you, basically, we set it up initially to fund if there was a government shutdown. However, we discussed this a little bit more in detail, and we don't want an exhibit or a something in this nature like the Butterfly Conservatory, which really was a very, very good project and very, very successful, to be threatened by a shutdown. So we, over $80,000, we want to make sure that they have the funds they need to continue these kind of projects in the next year. So we take it away from this year and put it into next year, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Hewitt, you have testifiers?
I do.
Mr. Feakin.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Neil Feakin. I am the Grassland Conservation Program Director for the Nature Conservancy here in Minnesota. And I am pleased to be here before you today in support of House File 970. I believe the story of the demise of the Dakota Skipper and the Poa-Sheek Skipperling butterflies really closely mirrors the overall story of the loss of our prairie landscape across the state. Once among Minnesota's most common butterfly species, over the last 10 to 15 years, these prairie butterflies have effectively disappeared from our state. And while the reason for this precipitous decline is still under investigation, Minnesota Zoo has taken a lead role in stepping up and helping answer what these questions, what the reason for this decline is. And I applaud the zoo for stepping in and playing a lead role in this. They recognized the need early on, right around 7 or 8 years ago. They recognized that we're losing these butterflies, and they established a captive breeding program right there in Apple Valley. And that gives us, I believe, the best chance to ensure the long-term survival of these two very iconic species. And I'll add that this captive breeding program was started from scratch. Nobody really knew how to breed these species in captivity before, and it's now universally recognized that the zoo is a world leader in this work. And they're looked to provide information and guidance for other conservation efforts across the country and across the world. The Nature Conservancy and our partners, including Minnesota DNR, Fish and Wildlife Service, and others, have worked closely with the zoo over the last 7 years to protect and restore habitat that's going to be necessary for when they get these captive breeding populations up and they're looking for reintroduction sites. In fact, the zoo has had enough success with their program that they've actually established new populations on Nature Conservancy and other properties over the last 2 years. And I believe we're at a point in this conservation story where either continued or, in fact, increased funding will play a critical role and make a critical difference in making sure that we're able to save these two Minnesota iconic species. The zoo is leading on a number of fronts on this. In addition to their captive rearing program, they're providing monitoring services on natural habitats to try and locate remnant populations. And this is no small task. Identifying these species in the field is very difficult, and there's very, very few experts and qualified individuals able to do that. The zoo has that expertise to help get that done. They're evaluating habitat for future restorations. And they're playing a critical role in researching the reason for the disappearance of these two butterfly species. Having worked very closely with the zoo on this program over the last 7 years, I personally have high confidence in their ability to deliver meaningful conservation results, and I would encourage your support for this investment through this appropriation. Thank you.
Representative Hewitt, do you have another testifier?
No, I believe that's it.
I think you do.
There is one more. Wow. Never would my mother think I was going to be up here defending butterflies. Never.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Erin Roop. I run Pollinate Minnesota, which is a pollinator education and advocacy organization. I also had the honor to serve on Governor Dayton's Pollinator Committee for the past 2 years. And through that work, we got to tour the Butterfly Conservation Center at the U. If you haven't been there, I encourage you to go. It's totally fascinating. I just confirmed this with Dr. Eric Rehnquist, who runs this program, but there are fewer power sheep skipperlings than there are pandas by like 8 times. They used to be among our most common butterfly. They're no longer found in the state. We have more Dakota skippers than we have power sheep skipperlings, but their populations are also in decline. And I learned from Sarah Foltz-Jordan, who also sat on the governor's committee with me from the Xerces Society, that according to NatureServe, at least 18% of North American butterfly species, which is about 141 species, are considered at risk of extinction. Historically rare specialist butterflies are at risk, and we are also seeing declines of these butterflies that were once wide-ranging and common, like power sheep. The zoo's conservation program on these two species is establishing a model for reintroduction that would provide some transferable lessons to these other species. There are no other active prairie butterfly conservation programs in the U.S., and only Winnipeg has another in the world. So we're super lucky to have this incredible program here in our state, and I encourage all of you to go and see this space. These are butterflies, right? They're caterpillars when they're young. And the Dakota skipper is a caterpillar that eats grass and lives on grass species and builds this little hut for itself out of grass. It's totally cool. So I wanted to voice my strong support for this House File 970. Thank you.
Any questions from members for Representative Hewitt or the testifiers? Any questions? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Representative Hewitt, any closing remarks?
Mr. Chair and committee, thank you for hearing this bill today. And again, I ask you to hold it over for consideration in your omnibus.
I renew my motion that House File 970 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Representative Morrison. Representative Morrison, would you like to move your bill to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that House File 776 is moved to be considered in the omnibus bill.
Representative Morrison, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, House File 776 appropriates money from the general fund to the Board of Water and Soil Resources to provide local government grants to landowners to plant residential lawns with native vegetation and pollinator-friendly forbs and legumes. We tend to think of cities as being poorer in biodiversity, but new research is showing that urban and suburban areas may play a key role in conserving pollinator communities. I do have a testifier who happens to be a constituent here to testify on behalf of this bill. Patricia Hauser. Thank you.
Ms. Hauser.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, my name is Patricia Hauser. I'm from Shorewood, Minnesota. I'm a retired teacher from the Minneapolis Public Schools and co-founder of Humming for Bees, a grassroots 100% volunteer organization that started in 2014 and helped pass the first Bee Safe City resolution in the state. There are now 40 communities that have passed such resolutions. I'm going to start by apologizing because I assume that a lot of you already know some of the things I'm going to say, but I'm going to repeat them because I can use them maybe to illustrate a new point. Thank you. Lawns to legumes. What a great plan to support pollinators. You all know that bees and other pollinators are in serious decline in Minnesota and actually nationally and globally. Two of the many factors in their decline are lack of habitat and poor nutrition. The Land to Legumes bill addresses these issues. Bee and pollinator food comes from flowering plants. But flowers alone are not enough. It must be flowers that bees and other pollinators like, and it must fill their nutritional needs. Not all flowers are the same, and not all pollinators like the same flowers. Pollinators need a place to live and food to eat. And isn't it ironic that bees and other pollinators that give us, all of us, such wonderful variety in our food, in our plant food, isn't it ironic that they themselves are starving? We get to eat such foods as fruit, nuts, vegetables, and a lot of times they have grass. They do not even have enough flowers to eat from. In Shorewood, we have plenty of open space, especially lawns and blacktop. Did you know that after corn and soybeans, grass is Minnesota's third largest crop? However, our bees, butterflies, flies, and other pollinators don't eat grass, and much of our landscape is grass, a food desert for pollinators. When they don't eat grass, they grow hungry, and they get weakened. And when that happens, they're more susceptible to viruses, parasites, pesticides. In this lawn to legumes bill, you are giving more Minnesotan pollinators an opportunity to eat better and hopefully supply some of the essential puzzle pieces to help them thrive, habitat and food. Lawns with pollinator-friendly plants will go a long way in feeding these endangered creatures and helping with habitat. And for all of the cities, counties, and schools, and individual landowners who want to do something to help pollinators, some guidance and financial support in the form of grants is a perfect opportunity. As I mentioned, there are 40 communities that have passed pollinator resolutions, and that's only growing. I can't go anywhere, you know, grocery store, the dentist, wherever, and people talk about pollinators with emotion. Minnesotans do care about pollinators, and they care about pollinator decline, and they want to protect pollinators. This land to legumes bill is an investment not only in pollinators, but in our health and survival. Lawns to legumes is, a win-win nonpartisan bill because we all rely on pollinators for food variety. Please support this lawns to legumes bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Morrison, do you have another testifier?
Mr. Chair, I do. I believe Ms. Roop is going to testify on behalf of Lawns to Legumes as well. Thank you.
Ms. Roop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I just talked to you on the previous bill. You might see me a few more times.
State your name for the record.
Correct. My name is Erin Roop of Pollinate, Minnesota. Thank you again for having me. I wanted to speak a little bit to our work as the Governor's Pollinator Committee. So I was one member out of 15. We met for 2 years. We came up with close to 40 recommendations on how to protect pollinators in Minnesota. We did a gap analysis of habitat programs that are happening and what the language that is in Lawns to Legumes fits our top three priority habitat recommendations. And of our 15 diverse members, these recommendations were voted on with unanimous support. One of them, 14 of us supported it. Most of us thought these were priorities too. So expanding funding and eligibility criteria for pollinator habitat and management practices on rural lands beyond what is already provided. I think Lawns to Legumes would meet that audience residentially. And then establishing a turf conversion and enhancement program focused on replacing or enhancing turf with flowering habitat in urban, suburban, and rural non-ag lands. That fits right in here. And also, the clause that I'm excited about as an educator is encouraging and incentivizing new public education facilities, existing public education facilities, to include pollinator landscaping on their grounds. We authored and prioritized these recommendations because there's a critical habitat need in this area and also because there's so much interest from Minnesotans, as Patricia mentioned. I work with school districts around the state and hear from teachers and administrators often, and there are a few funding sources that exist already for increasing pollinator habitat on school grounds, but there is so much excitement that I'm hearing from this constituency, these groups, for this legislation. So I wanted to voice that to you all. Those spaces are not just food for bees, but they're also incredibly active learning spaces for teachers and for students. And cities and counties are also very excited about this program. Yesterday, the Homegrown Minneapolis Food Council passed a unanimous motion in support of this House File 776. I also think that by creating this pool of money that
there's potential to encourage more of our Minnesota communities to be pollinator-friendly, which is such an exciting mechanism for pollinator protection. So for all of these reasons, I'm voicing my strong support for House File 776. Thank you.
Any questions from members? Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had some visitors in my office a couple of weeks ago from a golf course owners association, and I asked them questions about pollinators and herbicides, and they said that they were doing their best in both those areas, being careful about the chemicals they used on the lawns. And I'm not aware with all the language which is used here. Forbs and is legumes just well, can you explain what forbs and legumes are, and would they be appropriate for planting on the golf courses in my district?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sandell, I believe that legumes come from the pea family, and forbs are flowering grasses. I believe that is correct. And so, sure, those could be planted on the edge and the rough of a golf course.
Excuse me. And, Mr. Chair, it also mentions cities and schools, I guess. Would owners of private golf courses be available for the grants?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sandell, the first year is intended for private landowners, and the subsequent years are for public spaces, so land associated with cities and public schools. So I don't know how a private golf course would fit into that. It's possible in the first year there would be some that might fit into that category. But the intent more is to transform. I don't think most golf courses are going to want to transform the bulk of their grass into this kind of a thing. So I think it's more intended for people with big lawns.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Anyone in the audience? Representative Morrison, any closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thanks for hearing the bill. I hope that you will support it, if for no other reason than it has one of the best names of a bill ever, and I have to credit Chair Hansen with it. It's almost as good as No Child Left Inside. Thank you.
Representative Morrison renews her motion that House File 776 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The bill is laid over.
Thank you.
Representative Akam.
Bless you.
I will move that House File 1092 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Akam, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to present House File 1092 today, which is the Native Bee Survey funding. This bill appropriates $636,000 to the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources to survey the status and distribution of native bee populations in deciduous and coniferous forest regions of Minnesota. This work will build upon an earlier study done by the DNR in 2014 of wild bees in prairie and grassland habitats throughout the state, and supports ongoing efforts by the governor's office, state agencies, and the Minnesota legislature to address pollinator policy and protection. Wild bees are a vital part of our state's ecosystem, with nearly all of our flowering plants and trees depending upon insect pollinators. Almost a third of our agricultural crops also depend upon bees. And while there are approximately 400 species of bees currently documented in Minnesota, the health and wild bee population is uncertain. Successful enhancements of pollinator habitat depends on baseline data about our wild bees. With this survey, we'll be able to intervene and conserve important pollinators like native bees more effectively by having a more detailed picture of population trends and distributions, high priority habitat areas, and effects of potential threats and land management actions. There are a couple of testifiers that would like to testify on behalf of this bill. So first we have Margaret Monson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Margaret Monson. I live in St. Paul. I am an entomologist and a beekeeper. And so I am going to try to convince you why it's important to study Minnesota bees, or continues to study Minnesota native bees, as opposed to honeybees, which were brought to this country in the 1600s to pollinate certain crops and are entirely managed by beekeepers. The 469 species of native bees have been here for millions of years before the honeybees were introduced. I did leave some color photos. I hope some of you got them that I passed around. They're photos from Heather Holm. They are just one-fifth of the different species of native bees. 5%, I'm sorry, not one-fifth, 5% of the native bees that you could see if I could copy them all. The most easily recognized native bees are the bumblebees. They're larger, they're usually more noisy than the other bees, and they're the only true social native bees, because like honeybees, bumblebees have a nest with a queen and workers and a drone. They usually live in underground abandoned rodent burrows. Occasionally I've found them in a birdhouse and once behind a rock wall. They're very large, very fuzzy, and they're the most efficient pollinators of many crops. Think of tomatoes and peppers and blueberries and cranberries as examples. But they're the only ones, the native bees are the only ones that pollinate our wild places, woodlands, wetlands, prairies, because these native bees evolved right along with the plants in those places. So they depend on each other. Apart from social bumblebees, the other native bees are considered solitary because the queen works all by herself to construct a nest. Most of them occupy underground cavities, crevices, abandoned insect tunnels, and they provision these nests with pollen that they collect from various flowering plants. They bring it back to this pre-selected place, lay an egg on the pollen, create a little separation in that space, and go back out and get more pollen. The separations are created by the bee. They're usually plant material, grasses, leaves, some soil. And they keep going back, getting the pollen and the nectar, bringing it back to the crevice, laying the egg on the pollen, and filling that space up. And when she gets done, she caps it off, and she starts again with another place to lay eggs. These are all entirely underground. Then she dies after she's finished laying eggs. Her progeny are underground all the rest of the season, all winter, especially cold winters like this. They're there, and they don't come out until the next spring when the adults emerge. The other solitary bees make their homes above ground in hollow or pithy plant stems or crevices in wood. The females excavate that space. They create those divisions again where they bring pollen, lay eggs, and keep filling up that space with pollen and eggs. The most easily observed indications that you might have a solitary bee in your yard is some of them are called the leafcutter bees, and they cut amazingly perfect round holes, but they match up with the diameter of the pre-selected stem they've chosen, and they bring those back with the pollen and the egg, put a little round circle of a leaf in there, go back out, bring back pollen, lay eggs, and so on until that stem or that crevice is all filled up, but the little cavities are separated by pieces of leaves. We don't usually see these unless you happen to be watching, but if you keep your eye out for perfectly little round holes in leaves, not in a regular pattern, just scattered here and there, you might be able to see the evidence of a leafcutter bee. These natives emerge at different times in spring and summer. The earliest I've ever seen have been in March, even on very cold days with few plants in bloom, but they come out from those underground burrows, and they pollinate the early spring. Their pollination or their activity is synchronous with early spring natives like passiflower and prairie smoke and bloodroot. So why is it so important to continue studying these bees? Because apart from being aesthetically appealing and fascinating to a lot of us, more importantly, because they only they make possible sustainable ecosystem function, those woodlands, those wetlands, those prairies. If we don't know their behaviors and understand how they fit into the big picture, then how can we protect these wild places that most of us appreciate? It's easier to appreciate and conserve something if we understand the habitat it requires and what it needs to be nourished. But now I know you've all heard about the most abundant and conspicuous bumblebee. It used to be in the past decade was the rusty patch in eastern United States and into Canada. It's now on the endangered list. It's lost 90% of its range and its abundance. Not only are bumblebees all considered to be keystone species for the pollination of wildflowers, but they're essential for creating native seeds and fruits upon which other wildlife like songbirds depend. And economically, estimates as to the value of our native insects as crop pollinators are about $3 billion in the U.S. We need them.
and they need us to protect them and enhance their habitats, making it possible for them to continue their amazing yet often underappreciated work for us and the environment. And I thank you for taking time to hear this, and I hope you will support House File 1092.
Any questions for the testifier? Is there anyone who would like like to testify for or against the bill? I think we're going to try to move. Representative Acuff, any closing remarks?
No, I just ask for your support.
I will renew my motion that House File 1092 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The bill is laid over.
Thank you.
Representative Lippert. I will move that House File 1413 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Lippert, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. In November, the journal Science Advances published a study on natural climate solutions. It found that managing the nation's landscapes with carbon in mind could cut greenhouse gas emissions by as much as 21%, or about equal to the discharge of all cars and trucks on the roads today. Minnesota was identified in the report as among the states that could positively impact carbon emissions the most through land management solutions. Minnesota has the potential to reduce our net carbon emissions by up to a third through natural climate solutions. The natural climate solutions for Minnesota include replanting forests, better management of nitrogen manure, planting cover crops, extending the life of trees before harvesting them for timber, and restoring wetlands and prairies. House File 1413 focuses on getting started on one of these natural climate solutions, transitioning grasslands to prairies for the sake of carbon sequestration. The bill calls on the Commissioner of Natural Resources to develop a plan for converting brome and other grasslands with relatively shallow root systems to restored prairie with deeper root systems for carbon sequestration. The plan will identify state lands available for conversion, require that the prairie restorations meet applicable Board of Water and Soil Resources, Native Vegetation and Enhancement guidelines, and identify the funding and activities necessary to achieve all initial plantings by 2030. And with me to testify and say more is Professor Jason Hill from the University of Minnesota.
Dr. Hill.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, I'm Jason Hill, Associate Professor in the Department of Bioproducts and Biosystems Engineering at the University of Minnesota. Minnesota's prairies are one of our state's great natural resources. They provide tremendously rich soil for farming and support wildlife and habitat for hunting. It's not an underestimate to say that our soils are the envy of the world. They are also tremendous stores of carbon. Much of the prairie in the state was plowed, less than 1% remains, and much of the carbon in their soils was lost, along with the diversity of plants and animals that the prairie supported. Some land in Minnesota's prairie region, such as the lands considered in this bill, were for various reasons retired from crop production and planted to brome grass, a European native grass. While this largely stops soil carbon loss, it only very slowly rebuilds carbon in the soils. It's akin to if you were to stop spending from your savings account, but rely only on interest for it to grow in value. Restoring such lands instead to diverse prairie, the same species that created these rich soils, greatly increases soil carbon storage rates. This is because a diverse prairie takes greater advantages of the resources that promote plant growth. Shallow-rooted plants use soil moisture near the surface, while deep-rooted plants use soil moisture deep underground. Some plants, like legumes, which you've heard about, can take nitrogen from the air, and others, like big bluestem, Indian grass, and switchgrass, use it efficiently to grow tall and have deep root structures. There are plants that grow early in the spring, and others that flourish late in the fall. Let's put this in the most Minnesotanist of terms, the state fair. Think of the profitability of food sales like carbon storage. Prairies are like the state fair as you know it today. You can gorge on a variety of foods from sunrise to sunset, savory, sweet, fatty, all delicious. This supports rich business environment, highly profitable for the food stands. Lands planted to brome grass is like if the fair only sold mini donuts. Sure, they're delicious, but would you eat as much? food stand profitability, or carbon gains in this analogy, are greatly reduced. I was asked by Representatives Lippert and Eugenius to estimate potential soil carbon from converting state-owned lands to restored prairie. A very rough estimate is about half a ton of carbon dioxide per acre per year for converting brome to diverse prairie. This is about 5,000 tons of carbon dioxide every year for every 10,000 acres converted. This is equivalent to the carbon released by burning about 400,000 gallons of gasoline. This analysis assumes that the carbon storage rates on the DNR lands are similar to those found north of the Twin Cities, where the soils are actually pretty sandy. If some of the DNR lands are on richer soils, and I imagine they are, these rates could be higher. As such, the estimate I gave is probably a lower bound. Finally, in addition to the carbon benefits I described, such conversion would provide a number of other environmental benefits, many of which you've heard about in earlier testimony this afternoon. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions from members? Any questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify for or against the bill? Representative Lippert, any closing remarks?
Just ask for your support. Thank you.
I will renew my motion that House File 1413 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over.
Aye.
Aye.
Madam Chair, I would move that House File 1374 be considered for laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Thank you, Chair.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House File 1374 is a bill to try to reach a variety of landowners who participate in the voluntary Federal Conservation Reserve Program. As many members know, the Farm Bill was just recently renewed, but as it was renewed with some conditions on Conservation Reserve, where there will be a lower rental rate. I think it's set at 85% of the county average rental rate. And rental rates are based on the soil types, and the contracts for Conservation Reserve are based on the environmental benefits. Environmental benefits could be water quality, soil health, groundwater, surface water, wildlife habitat, pollinator habitat. There are a variety of Conservation Reserve program parts. What this bill would do is provide incentives to landowners who sign up for the federal program, and it gives the authority to the Board of Water and Soil Resources to set incentives. So that may mean that a landowner goes into the federal FSA, NRCS offices and signs up for CRP, but then they go down the hall to the Soil and Water Conservation District office and they can get an incentive payment based on the acres and the benefits that are achieved. So it provides a financial incentive for the contracts or for sign-up bonuses. I'm not prescriptive. I'm permissive in terms of how to set those benefits. The Conservation Reserve Program is probably the fastest and the largest way to affect habitat, water quality, wildlife habitat that we have in our state. Most of the things we talk about are dealing with relatively small amount of acres, but this is a voluntary program that can reach a large amount of acres, and I believe it would be in the state's interest to enhance that. And I have with me one, potentially more, testifiers.
Thank you. For the record.
My name is Erin Roop of Pollinate, Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm here to voice my support of House File 1374. As you've heard in testimony earlier today from Patricia Hauser and Margaret Munson, there are a number of known drivers of pollinator decline, and lack of clean food is one of these main drivers. The CRP program has potential, as Representative Hansen just said, to reach a huge number of acres. As a beekeeper myself, the health of my hives relies on my relationship with landowners, with farmers. Minnesotan farmers are like all of us as Minnesotans. We're all very concerned about this pollinator decline issue. Farmers are very interested in planting habitat for bees on farm, and providing the CRP incentive, as House File 1374 does, provides this funding stream so farmers can increase this on-farm habitat. Through my work on Governor Dayton's Pollinator Committee, I learned that one barrier in Minnesota to pollinator conservation, to this habitat install on farm, is limited technical help on the ground. And by providing funding through the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, through Bowser, this bill provides for the technical assistance that farmers and other landholders need to implement and manage successful habitat installations. I strongly support House File 1374. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Thank you. And please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Cowan, and I come before you today as a member of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership Pollinator Cluster. And my testimony is simple. I speak not only in support of this bill, but the prior five bills, because what I've talked to a lot of people about over the past few years is just real simple, and I haven't met anybody yet who disagrees. If you have clean water and healthy soil, you have happy pollinators. When you have happy pollinators, you have food to eat, you have plant life, and you have air to breathe. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions from the committee? Another testifier. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Lance Ness, President of the Minnesota Conservation Federation and the Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance. We support 1374 strongly and thank Representative Hansen for his work.
Thank you. Seeing no other people coming forward to testify, no other questions, Representative Hansen, do you have any closing remarks?
Thank you.
Would you like to renew your motion?
I would renew my motion that House File 1374 be laid over for possible inclusion.
The bill is laid over, and unless there's any other business, we are adjourned.